heard my heart beat all afternoon. After my chores, I sat here like this.
Hear that tired old man just in from a day's work farming his fields? He's not a figment of a playwright's imagination, but a traditional method actor's creation based on how the actor thinks the old man of the playwright's mind might behave. That's the way a method actor works, creating characters out of a blend of the script and the actor's own experience and interpretation. Rolando Arroyo Sucre, director of the New Age Hispanic American Repertory Theater Company, says he teaches his actors to stop being that middleman, taking the script more literally.
We do not believe that there is anything that we cannot figure out from what is being said. And in that regard, punctuation, for instance, and grammar, give you all the information you need in terms of developing a speech pattern of someone who's very calm or someone who's very hyper, and you have all this data right there instead of having to create from personal experience this situation.
What does that mean for the old man we heard wheezing at the beginning of this report? To play this scene for the New Age production of I, Too, Speak of the Rose by Mexican author Emilio Carballido, actor Ken Walsh takes his own interpretations out of the way, and the old man emerges as a happier person, revitalized by his work, not beaten by it.
I heard my heart beat all afternoon. After my chores, I sat here, like this, quietly.
That speech, encouraging the audience to pay more attention to details, opens I, Too, Speak of the Rose. Drawn from a newspaper item the author once read, it's the story of two kids who accidentally derail a train. The incident is told over and over by parents, teachers, police officers, and psychologists. Each character retells this bit of history with his or her own explanation. From the teacher's claim that the kids didn't have enough discipline to the psychologist's complex tale of sexual repression. It's played for laughs, but Arroyo Sucre is sure this story would become a farce if presented by traditional American method acting instead of through this broader Hispanic technique.
With the available techniques, it's extremely difficult to produce most Hispanic plays in this country without making them look extremely corny. There is no traditional technique how to perform a ghost, for instance. How do you produce a Brazilian play like The Wedding Dress by Nelson Rodriguez, where a woman who is dying generates another hallucination image within her head, and this other hallucination image sees her own corpse on stage? You do not have any tools in realistic acting to produce this kind of effect.
To remove cultural barriers that might exist in other translated works, Arroyo Sucre has written a cultural translation of this story, changing the two Mexico City kids into Chicago punks who raid payphones for change and practice graffiti art on a street corner. That's a scenario to which the audience and the local actors can relate. To further immerse the audience in the story, Arroyo Sucre adds one more twist. His actors refuse to let audience members be merely spectators. They're drawn into the action with gestures, asides, and even point-blank stares. That, says actor Ken Walsh, is the toughest part of this job for those actors trained in the traditional method school.
What I had learned was to communicate the feelings to myself and the other people in the play. And what I've learned here is to communicate primarily to the audience. We use a lot of three-quarter turns, so you're actually not seeing the person that you're talking to, but it looks like you are from the audience. This was something that I had a very difficult time doing because I'd always been trained that when you talk to somebody, you look in their eyes. And it was really a very day and night change for me.
But a rewarding change, says Walsh, who once gave up his theater career because of frustrations with method acting.
When I was told to live the role, I'd take it home with me. I'd live it And if the person was somebody that I couldn't stand, I was living in an awful place. And so I thought, well, there has to be another way of doing this, because it would come out fine. It would come out very convincing. But on the other hand, I just didn't want to live like that. I thought it was enforced schizophrenia.
There's something else that sets this company's work apart from most other American productions. Director Arroyo Sucre says his shows look and feel more like music videos than like plays, thanks to a multimedia combination of original artwork that decorates an otherwise sparse set and a creative musical score developed by composer and actor Mark Houston to change with every shift in action.
It's a striving for more synergy between the words and the mood of the scene, as opposed to having background music, so to speak, where you could take records and say, well, this kind of goes generally with the mood of the scene in general. It's trying to coordinate it more, even with specific words.
Houston went so far as to time certain scenes and to gauge their tempo with a metronome to be sure his music helps create that synergy. When it's all put together, audience members are treated to a production they label refreshing and invigorating, often without knowing exactly why this affects them so differently than does a traditional performance. But Arroyo Sucre knows why, and he's convinced his non-method methods can be applied to American standards as well as to translated works to revitalize the U.S. theater.
Our belief within the company is that the only reason why the theater is not succeeding as much as it could is because it's not focusing on the market, on the audience, on who is the individual who is going to be benefited or enjoy our services.
In the future, Arroyo Sucre hopes to stage some American productions, possibly with the support of a New York producer interested in his methods. For now, the New Age Hispanic American Repertory Company is engrossed in I Too Speak of the Rose, running through March 14th in Chicago's Charlie Chaplin Auditorium, just down the street from the old movie studio where Chaplin's Little Tramp offered the world his unique methods. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago. They started with character sketches from the playwrights, and in some cases, an outline of a story. From there, the improvisational actors went to work, using theater games to develop the action. Like this exercise, where I supplied a random opening line to get two actors started, while the rest of the company coached from the sidelines.
Give me a first line of dialogue.
First thing that you thought of this morning when you woke up.
There's no way I'm getting up now.
Right.
Go for it.
Go. There's no way I'm getting up this morning.
Nobody asked you to get up.
I have to get up for work today. You've got that beautiful car that I bought you, and I'd really hate to see you lose it.
I can call you.
Bring up things that aren't present.
All right. Yeah. All right. You're right. Yeah. You're right. That was it. That was the name of the game right there.
Fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
The mistake was bringing up the car. In this improv game, actors aren't allowed to introduce objects from the outside world. On stage, no one is allowed to move the story forward without justification. Actor Charles Hartsock says every gesture has to be explained.
What you find yourself doing a lot of times is miming things with your hands, but you have no idea what you're holding. And all of a sudden, somebody off stage would yell at you, "What are you holding?" And you'd have to determine right then and there what it is.
Did I show you my beeper?
No.
Yeah, I got this beeper, so if my wife goes into labor and I'm not around, she just beeps me.
Oh, Phil, isn't it a modern world? Beep, 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 your baby's coming.
Anywhere I go.
Yeah. Look at you. You're so proud of your house and your baby and your beeper. Look at you.
Yeah.
That's just great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jess? Huh? I don't know how this thing works.
While the actors are playing their improv games, the playwrights are taking notes, working out the scenes. For writers used to working alone, that role required some adjustment, according to director Michael Gilman.
Once they did, they really enjoyed it, because all of a sudden their characters come to life in front of them, and they could manipulate them, or we could manipulate them. We could say, how about if he goes over there, and do the same process the writer does, but with other minds working on it.
There are times, of course, when the playwrights are not happy about the direction in which the actors are taking their characters. That's when Gelman steps in, acting as mediator. In a more conventional play, the director acts as a faithful interpreter, keeping the actors glued to their script. But actor Charlie Hartsock says that changes when there is no script.
In this process, there are six actors, a director, and a writer coming together to make that final, that whole.
But isn't there a point somewhere where you must wonder, all these people are getting in the way? I mean, too many cooks, you know? There's no,
no
point where...
No, because my mind can only go so far with an idea. And when that runs out, one of these other five crack improvisers, a writer or director, can say, push it. Look at it. Develop it.
And that's a process that continues well past opening night. These improv actors don't know the meaning of the phrase, that's a wrap. And maybe that's for the best, since these sketches still have some rough edges. Critics like the study of a reclusive doll maker and the story of an egotistic columnist who loses his job. But the third, an office comedy, was labeled by one critic a disaster. A disappointing review, to be sure, but one that might not stick for the duration of the show. Writer Deb LaCosta says reviewers and the audience know these plays are still evolving. She says an improv audience comes to appreciate the flaws and the fun.
They know that they're coming to see something that's going to be somewhat fresh every time, and not just another version of Do Black Patent Leather Shoes Really Reflect Up?
Right.
That sense of danger, that's what we're about. His name here is Khan, Joe Khan. My space, icon. Don't you love it? Icon, icon. The pundit as enigma. Hell yes, I'm good. I am the absolute...
If they're coming out, oh, let's go to the theater, it's Saturday night, let's go out and do something, and they expect to go to Victory Gardens and Steppenwolf and see the same production that was last Friday, exact same blocking, exact same moment, done at the exact same time, they should go down there.
The actors at those other theaters, though, are keeping an eye on the Organic Company's improv experiment. Director Gelman says members of Chicago's theater community readily share techniques, and on some nights, there may be as many actors in the Seed Show's audience as there are on stage. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
The portrait of Gertrude Stein, which is at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, has been enlarged. It's 16 feet by 14 feet. This gigantic portrait is leaning up against the sky, and a silhouette of Picasso in a deck chair looking up at it is the first image that the audience sees when they come into the theater.
She always said Pablo is a multimedia show, a skilled mix of the talents of the subjects of the story as well as of the theater company. We learn about the friendship between Pablo Picasso and Gertrude Stein through a collage of Stein's essays, poetry, and the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which Stein actually wrote about her good friend. The passages from that book are what keep the story on track. Several of the principals, including the director, describe this as a risk-taking show. Actress Margie Bank, who plays the part of Toklas, says without her it would be a bit too surrealistic.
I sort of narrate the play a little bit, and I'm the only one who the audience can maybe immediately recognize and understand. Actually, I don't really even know what this play is about, but I think that in the same way that you don't have to understand a circus, or you don't have to understand a play. It's an aesthetic experience. And I think people might be in trouble if they come thinking that they have to understand.
The passages by Toklas are the bits of reality that give shape to the play's dreamlike passages, in which director Frank Galati has woven together both Stein's and Picasso's works. The thought of seeing familiar Picasso paintings, dancing and singing, was Galati's inspiration for this show, along with a desire to spread Stein's fame of the 20s and 30s into the 80s and 90s.
She was a celebrity, and an eccentric, a great hostess, a historical figure, a wild woman, a friend of the greats. Of course, she's well known as a writer for her circularity and her famous reiteration, a rose is a rose is a rose, and others, but it's very rarely that her works have taken the stage.
Helen Furr was gay there. She was gayer and gayer there. And really, she was just gay there. She was gayer and gayer there. That is to say, she found ways of being gay there that she was using in being gay there.
Gertrude Stein may seem to some a rather obscure and difficult writer, because one is not always able to follow the sense of every line. But hanging on to the individual moment is a real pleasure. I hope that it's the joy of performance and the beauty of the spectacle and the incredible beauty of Virgil Thompson's score and Igor Stravinsky's music also that we're using that will keep the audience borne aloft, so to speak.
Director Galati livens up Stein's difficult writings with a continual parade of Picasso-esque props, from eye masks that look as though they were sliced from some of Picasso's abstract portraits to giant blow-ups of Picasso's paintings that roll across the stage on wheels as a sort of moving backdrop to the actors. That gives the play the feel of a street scene, a live version of the street performers or saltimbanque that Picasso so often put into his work.
We wanted the audience to be able to acquire Picasso's images in a way that they couldn't acquire them in a book or by going to a gallery. We didn't want this to be a slide lecture of the paintings of Picasso, and we didn't want it to be the history of 20th century art or put up a painting and read a poem in front of it. You know, I mean, what could be more boring than that?
Galati refuses the title of writer. He says Stein wrote this show, but he's responsible for putting it together, a project born out of his fascination with Stein and Stein's with Picasso, the subject of several of her writings.
She begins this word portrait by suggesting that he was completely charming, that he was charming, and that he was working, that he was not ever completely working, but that he was working, and that something was coming out of him.
He did have some following. They were always following him. Some were certainly following him. He was one who was working. He was one having something coming out of him, something having meaning. He was not ever completely working.
Frank Galati's admiration for Picasso and Stein, while clear throughout the show, really punches through in Alice Toklas's final speech, taken from Stein's book.
I may say that only three times in my life have I met a genius, and each time a bell within me rang and I was not mistaken. And I may say that in each case it was before there was any general recognition of the quality of genius in them. The three geniuses of whom I wish to speak are Alfred Whitehead, Gertrude Stein, and Pablo Picasso.
And that, perhaps, is the point of this show, to let the audience share that genius. But one leaves this audiovisual portrait still searching for meaning, and that, too, is the point of this show.
I think it's apocryphal that the very last thing that Gertrude Stein uttered before she died was Alice asked her, "What is the answer, Gertrude? What is the answer as you approach death?" She knew she was dying. She was on her deathbed. And she said, "What is the question?"
It's that search for meaning that each fresh audience is left to ponder, as did Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso. She always said Pablo is playing at the Goodman Theater through April 4th. For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago. If it weren't for the gaggle of reporters and cameras that followed Alderman Davis's every move, he would have been tough to spot walking through City Hall. The U.S. Marshals serving as his escorts wore plain clothes, as did Davis, permitted by the courts to leave behind his prison jumpsuit. Davis sat beneath a portrait of George Washington to preside over a city council committee meeting.
Police committee report is for 51 claims against the city of Chicago recommending due pass.
Davis spoke only on the record. The court barred him from talking directly to reporters. While Davis was on the council floor, he was not handcuffed, and marshals did not insist on remaining at his side. In fact, the council's sergeant-at-arms, Mike Coletta, wouldn't let them.
Nobody's allowed on the floor but an alderman, an ex-alderman, or a person invited by the mayor.
Wallace Davis is the latest in a long line of Chicago aldermen charged with variations on the graft theme. 18 aldermen have been indicted here in the last 20 years. In 1870, an entire faction of the council was thrown in jail for refusing to seat the winner of a hotly contested mayoral election. The dean of the City Hall Press Corps, Chicago Sun-Times reporter Harry Golden, says it's not even unusual for indicted aldermen to conduct city business.
And on a particular day in 1974, while the proceedings went forward with talk of reform, there were no fewer than 10 sitting or recently deposed aldermen indicted or convicted on federal charges.
What hasn't happened before is for an alderman to leave prison under federal guard, to be escorted through Chicago's City Hall. The court allowed Alderman Davis to do that after his lawyers argued constituents weren't getting fair representation from an alderman in jail. Some pundits suggest Alderman Davis doesn't meet the standard set in Chicago's heyday of corruption, but reporter Golden disagrees.
I mean, here's a guy under indictment for accepting thousands of dollars to do unlawful and wrongful favors for a person seeking city business, and then he compounds that alleged felony by attacking someone who's cooperating with the government. I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of.
It may be something for Chicago to be ashamed of, though. Alderman Ed Burke points out this city has long tried to shake its reputation for underhanded politics.
You'd have to ask some of the longtime observers of the city council whether or not the reputation of the council can be sullied any more than it has been in the past.
That's a question that may have to be answered after Alderman Davis and two other aldermen now under indictment stand trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Marge Halperin in Chicago.
Met a girl crazy for me. Summer days drifting away to all the summer nights.
In the starring role of Danny, the cool leader of the Burger Palace Boys, we find pharmaceutical salesman Byron Wood. Using contributions from friends and fans, Wood paid $725 for his role.
I've got a brother who's a professional singer, and I've kind of always envied his freedom to be able to get up and do this kind of thing. So I kind of wanted to do it for myself and enjoy it for myself.
Summer sun, something begun.
Wood plays opposite clothing store employee Kathy Willerts. She actually was the understudy for the $2,600 role of Sandy, Danny's wholesome, cute-as-a-button girlfriend. Kathy stepped in when the star, who also happened to be her boss's wife, got sick. The rest of the cast includes lawyers, entrepreneurs, and homemakers. Director Dennis Sacek patiently whips them into shape. He knows they and the friends and relatives who spend $35 apiece to see the performance are forming a solid bond with the theater that will last all year.
This particular benefit reaches out to the community in a way that allows professionalism to be brought to them and allows them to work with professionals. A lot of the people that go to the theater in the city of Chicago, somewhere along the line, experience the joy of performance. And when that joy is rekindled, they're more prone to attend the theater and to appreciate the difficulty that sometimes exists within a work.
Ladies and gentlemen on stage, please, Summer Lovin.
This year's production, Grease, has a simple theme. Boy meets girl, loses girl, gets girl back. Zacek says he chooses his charity shows carefully, looking for plot lines that will suit his amateur cast.
I think the only time that I would say that we had something that was close to disastrous was when we did The Hound of the Baskervilles, because the actors had to remember the plot, and it was...
That was hard.
It was very hard. It's hard when professionals do it.
Zacek works diligently with his cast, insisting they are actors, not amateurs. He won't dwell on their mistakes, copping the artistic plea that nobody really knows what a brilliant performance is anyway. But when pressed, Zacek admits these shows are far from perfect. Actors miss their cues, fall off stage, and of course forget their lines.
We have a rule that you have to go on stage off book on opening night, which is the same as closing night, and there are no prompters, so a lot of people are more ready than others. One of the classic examples was Irving Burstein, who has been one of the stars of the auction since the first year. When we were doing Tobacco Road, he got excited one night and skipped from Act 1 to Act 3, and we had to work our way back.
Well, I've never heard of anything so ridiculous. I always know my lines. That's the first thing that an actor should do is know his dialogue. Someone's bum-rapping me. They're jealous, that's why.
Byron and I had a scene with Irv, and he just stood and watched us trying to cover his tracks and was so engrossed in us covering for him, he kept on saying, "Oh, yes, and what else?" It was ridiculous.
Sherry Sturch is playing the $900 role of a gum-snapping high schooler this year. She says any onstage humiliation is worth enduring because of the friendships that grow in the weeks that precede showtime. That's what keeps her and Byron Wood coming back each year, checkbook in hand.
Everybody just gels together in 20 minutes. Everybody could be sharing their innermost secrets with each other. And it's real refreshing, and I only wish it would last longer than 6 weeks.
And I'm going to tell you, if you step on my lines again, I'm spilling your secrets, Byron, so watch it.
Oh, my God, on national.
The family spirit felt by any cast after weeks of hard work takes on a special meaning at this show, because the actors, musicians, and audience know this is more than just a job. They're supporting a local theater that will enjoy the payoff from this labor-intensive fundraiser throughout the year. This year's production of Grease, the Victory Garden's most successful charity show ever, raised a total of $29,000.
Fred.
For National Public Radio, I'm Arch Halperin in Chicago.
All right, we're going to do this again?
Yeah.